This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 16th of September 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 167, with me, Robert Bounds, and Steve Bloomfield.
On the show today, we'll be joined by Palestinian author and human rights lawyer Raja Shahadi, whose diary documents day-to-day minutiae while asking some big questions, all on Palestine's front line.
We'll talk to Michael Grigsby and Rebecca Tolle, whose reflective new film revisits Vietnam veterans and asks if peace of mind is a battle that can be won.
And this week, the Man Booker Prize nominees were announced. We'll be joined by panel judge, writer and journalist Amanda Foreman to learn how to write a winner.
All of that, plus a look ahead at the week's top stories and, of course, some great tunes right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. How's it hanging, Stephen?
It's going all right, Robert. Very, very good indeed.
I like that. We should always call each other by each other's full names.
Yes, okay. Well, for the entirety of the show.
I looked at your passport earlier in the week.
Did you really?
Yeah, that's why I've got
I wondered where that had gone.
Yeah, that's going to be... And today's guest, I've got his passport. We should essentially do.
We should get people to introduce themselves by their full names throughout the show.
Yeah, I like that.
Okay, and middle names as well. What's your middle name?
Edward.
Robert Edward Bound.
Yeah, Robert Edward Wardrop Bound. It's good, isn't it?
Robert Edward what?
Let's not go there. This isn't banter. Saying what my full name is isn't banter.
You've got a second middle name?
That's my mum's maiden name, you see.
Say it again.
Wardrop.
Robert Edward Wardrop Bound.
Yeah.
That's a good name.
That's all right, isn't it?
Yeah.
No smirking.
I'm not smirking. No, that was a genuine, like...
Through the glass.
That's an impressive name.
The besuited, for some reason, Jack Phillips. Jack, do you always get dressed up on a Sunday? Yeah, I didn't think courts were open on a Sunday. But nonetheless, Jack Phillips has got his suit on. He's studio managing today. Do you feel in safe hands? I think maybe he's put his suit jacket on.
I think that is exactly
lull
why.
Lull us into a false sense of security.
He's brushed his hair. He's put on his suit jacket. It's as if you know, he's a professional back there.
He is.
He's
very
good.
Out of church, I expect that's
very exactly
good
what it is.
For it.
He's just been to see his nan.
Yeah. Today we might have what you describe as a packed show.
Yes.
Reading the menu has kind of whetted my appetite.
Yes, lots of book stuff, lots of film stuff, some good chats. And we've had quite a good sort of cultural week here at Midori House, haven't we?
I don't know, have we?
Oh, yeah.
I've tried to not be here as much as is humanly possible. Only joking, of course.
I came down at, sort of, I think, on Wednesday lunchtime to the canteen.
Had a couple of great sessions.
Exactly.
Right? Midori House sessions in here.
I came down to the event space / kitchen area.
That sounds like a sort of gym in Covent Garden.
It does, doesn't it?
Sort of a nasty gym where sort of...
I'm heading down to the event space.
I'm going to the event space for some yoga.
Yes.
Phone my girlfriends.
I came down to the event space
/
kitchen to see a man with rather, I must say, unusual hair. It looked like, from a distance, a sort of quite bad late 80s, early 90s.
Don't go there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Peroxide job?
Don't say Captain Sensible.
No,
it
no.
Was in fact, Tim Burgess,
leads
the Charlatans. He's got this great new solo album out. I think we played a track from it on last week's Weekly. He did a Midori House session. It's going to be next week's Culture Show, Monday's Culture Show, tomorrow's Culture Show.
Indeed. He was absolutely brilliant once I sort of got past the hair.
Yeah, and he's a super nice man. I did that thing I don't often do, which is have my picture taken with you, Tim. It's just one of those things, you know, you sort of, it's nice when you're sort of buying records and you're 15, you're like, that's great. And then they come on your show and have a chat. Like 15 years later.
A few years later.
It's all right.
I guess that's the sort of thing you dream of as well when you're 15 as well, isn't it? That you think, wouldn't it be great to...
I'll
be a radio
show,
DJ, I'll have Tim Burgess on my show.
Yeah,
there we are.
Do you know who we're going to have on our show now, Steve?
You know what? When I was 15,
yeah,
I dreamt of one day hosting a radio show and being able to say, welcome Tom Edwards.
This is Monocle 24.
It's Monocle 24. It's about Sunday lunchtime in Britain, which means you're listening to the Monocle Weekly, episode 167 thereof, with me, Robert Bounds, and Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Rob. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm not too bad.
How fares the news next week?
Oh, there's a lot happening.
Can we, before we get onto that, yeah. Tom? Is it Tom? Thomas?
Oh, we're doing full names.
Yeah, my full name is Thomas Edwards.
Middle names?
Patrick.
Just Patrick?
Yes, just Patrick.
Thomas Patrick Edwards. Well,
he's making a face. He's lying.
I'm not at all.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. He's
TP,
got that...
some of my Irish friends call me. Patrick, quite a common middle name amongst the Irish.
Yeah.
So it's often abbreviated as such. First initial, second initial. TP.
You're not that Irish, though, are you?
A little bit.
Should we do some news?
Why not?
Yeah, so give us a little bit of a look ahead.
What's the news in surnames this week?
Ronald McDonald, it's not him personally, McDonald's, the hamburger group. Tomorrow, for the first time.
Have they ever been described as a hamburger group?
Like do you want to know what they're doing from tomorrow?
Yeah, go
in
on.
The United States of America,
yeah.
They're labelling every product that's available in their extensive menu with its calorific value for the first time to try and assist some of their diners who perhaps might be slightly overweight to better control their calorific intake.
That's a very good idea. What are people saying? Are they saying, oh, about time, Ronald?
I think there's been a lot of anger directed towards Ronald himself, which I think is unfair, because he's only a figurehead.
Yeah, all he does is he spends so much time cooking up delicious recipes and defeating the Hamburglar.
I was going to say, he has to contend with the Hamburglar. That's not easy.
No. You're dressed, your shirt's a bit Hamburglar-esque.
It was in honour of what's happening on Monday.
I'm dressed as Ronald
quick
McDonald's.
Teaser for you both. Let's take this meal, a Big Mac, fries, and a carbonated beverage.
Okay.
How many calories?
Ooh, 800.
What? I don't know much about calories.
I'm kind of...
1,000
no idea.
Calories.
1,140.
Is that bad?
That's quite a lot. Okay. It's more than half. In fact, more than half the... It's your entire daily
How are you meant to have how much is in a pint of beer, Tom?
That's actually minus 200 calories.
That's why I love it.
It's actively good for you.
Good.
Do not trust me on this. I'm not medically qualified.
It's
not actually medically accurate.
You have like 20 pints.
What I like was that Steve looked like he was considering whether that could be true for a moment.
I was also working out, so if you have a Big Mac meal and 5 pints...
6 pints, then you're in credit.
Then that cancels it out.
Yeah. I live my life by using that system.
Right.
Okay, so that's one thing.
So story one is McDonald's are going to put their calorific content on the menu.
That's from tomorrow.
What excitement.
What about Tuesday? How about this?
Yep.
What do you think if I say to you, traditional Chilean cowboys?
I don't know. I'm kind of thinking that it comes in a tin.
No, it's Chilean Independence Day on Tuesday.
Oh, God. That's a slur.
There's a lot of fiestas patrias taking place.
Yeah.
Well, the whole week, but Tuesday it all gets underway. Parades, dances, drinking.
And cowboys.
Traditional food. Mm. And, of course, the traditional Chilean cowboys will be there to entertain us.
Do they entertain you? What's the purpose of them? Are they proper rust about kind of cattle herding cowboys?
Yeah, they'll be parading, maybe doing some... rope tricks.
Yeah.
Our listeners can't see me
lassoes. Again, you're doing some lassoing there.
Maybe wearing chaps.
Yeah.
But it's a real spectacle.
Cool.
One to enjoy.
And is that going to be sort of across the world? But I don't know much about the Chilean diaspora. Oh, I hear there's quite a lot. Santiago Tarditi was telling me last week on the show called The Briefing there's lots of Chileans in the Falkland Islands now. That's one of the largest population groups.
There'll be a big fiesta patrias happening there that day. You can bet your bottom dollar.
Okay, cool. And what's your third story, Tom?
Looking ahead to Friday, a bit more cultural. This might be up your street, Rob. The San Sebastian Film Festival opens.
Yeah.
Well, what a treat there is. Work by Ken Loach, Oliver Stone, Bernardo Bertolucci. And particularly interesting is who these events choose to honour with their big celebratory anniversary awards. Dustin Hoffman is receiving the 60th anniversary Donostia Award for his work throughout, 3 or 4 decades?
Yeah, exactly.
Such masterpieces, I don't know. Kramer versus Kramer, Rain Man.
Exactly.
So many to choose from. The Graduate, a classic.
And also, the San Sebastian Film Festival, it's got a reputation of great films, obviously. It's quite a beautiful and sort of slightly austere place. The best thing about it is obviously the food. No one's not going to go. Dustin Hoffman's not going to not turn up. You might not turn up to Toronto because...
I love San Sebastian.
I mean, I love Toronto, right? It's amazing. But the food's better in San Sebastian.
It's the best thing. The Pinchos, strolling those little narrow streets. A surprise... A delicious surprise waiting around every corner. And you can eat some quite high-end food as well.
Mm.
I actually went to Arzak the last time I went there.
I don't know what that is.
It's the three Michelin-starred restaurant.
Oh, Tom.
What a tasting menu that was.
I think I need to go there and do a report from the San Sebastian Film Festival.
I highly recommend it.
Right, Tom Edwards, for the time being.
You need to get there before Marcus Hippie says, no, actually, this is definitely a thing for the menu.
Yeah.
Or you could fight it out. Anyway, you're ending it then, weren't you?
I was going to wrap it up there. I'm getting some signals from the other room, and we're going to wrap it up. Tom Edwards, thank you very much for your triple bill of what's coming up next week, news stories. Tom, thank you very much.
You're back with The Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Rob Bound. Our first guest today is a Palestinian lawyer, campaigner, and author whose expertise puts him at the forefront of the argument in a highly contested region. Raja Shahadi co-founded Al-Haq in 1979, the human rights organisation established by lawyers to defend Palestinians. In his new book, Occupation Diaries, he tells the day-to-day human stories of Palestine, a place where borders and freedom are constantly being redefined. Raja, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Now, you've been keeping a diary for
40 years.
Many, many years, many decades. This diary that you've published now, the Occupation Diaries, covers the 2 years building up to Palestine's bid for statehood in 2011. Why were those years in particularly so important, you think, to be discussed in this book?
Well, almost every year in the occupation is an important year because so much happens and so much can be written about. But I felt that the 2 years were rich in hopes that sometimes were dashed. And I wanted to write a book that would help people who follow the thing or who don't follow but are interested to know what it is like to live in a place like Palestinian-occupied territories. And I felt that the diary format made this possible because it's not political analysis that I'm interested in. It's the daily life and how you manage your life, how you survive in a situation with so much emotion, sometimes very anger, sometimes hate, and how do you deal with it all and manage to live a life, a rich life, as rich as it, you can make it. So I speak a lot about the garden, my garden, and the resort to the garden as a way of escape sometimes when escape is needed. And then, of course, there was the Arab Spring, which had a strong impact on Palestine, and I write about that. So a lot happened. And then there was, as you say, the bid for the Palestinian statehood.
Reading it, it's often the stories about that sort of everyday minutiae, whether it's, you know, trying to get post delivered, that really sort of tell us so much about what life is like there rather than, you know, the big political things, isn't it?
Yeah, I've noticed that people who come and visit, even if they had read so many books about the place, are always so surprised. They say, we could never have imagined it was like this. And so the challenge for me was how to evoke the life that is mine, that I'm so used to, and bring to people's consciousness and experience what I've experienced. So it also is a book of memories. So I also write a lot about the memories of how it used to be in order to show how things have changed from the past 10 years, the past 20 years, and show both the physical changes in the land and the emotional, psychological, and how these are affected by the political developments in the region.
Raja, I wanted to ask you about the sort of literary device of the diary as a way of, you know, in a diary, when you buy a diary the year before, there are 365 days in it, there's always a tomorrow. Is that something that you wanted to sort of get across by using the diary format, that one day might be bad, but, you know, the wind will be blowing from a different direction, the sun may be shining the next day, there'll be a different type of bloom on the trees. Is that something that...
I think that's a very good way of putting it. Yes, when you go into daily life, you know, the big mistake, which I now am very careful when I read about regions of conflict, the big mistake is when you read about the region of conflict, you think that life in that place is a series of these high points, because only the high points, only when there is violence, when there is dramatic events, are they reported. So in your mind, life in that place becomes the number of these high points.
Yeah.
But life is never like that. Even during an active war, there is daily life, there is routine, there are families, there is love affairs, and so on. And so it's very important to to find a device, a literary device, to bring these into the fore and show that life goes on despite everything.
And I guess there's also a humanity in that that isn't done by a sort of sweeping historical survey or an overtly political book. Something that is essentially a diary can be made personal, and it can be made intimate to the person that writes it and the people that he interacts with.
Absolutely, absolutely. Especially that I write also about interaction with Israelis and how that changed over the years, and how painful sometimes that is when you are unable to reach out to the humanity of the other. Yes, so it is a good device, the diary, to also to write about small things. I write about the story of the mouse, for example.
Yeah.
A mouse escaped and supposedly from a settlement, and it had some Hebrew writing, and everybody was so worried that it was going to bring disease to our area. And it's fascinating little story that I happened to hear going in the shared taxi, and that I reported in my diary.
And it's a funny thing, like the wartime diaries, First and Second World wartime diaries, are probably familiar to some of our listeners, also have these similar ideas, actually, where the protagonists become obsessed with an animal that they keep alive during their captivity. It's a similar sort of leitmotif.
Perhaps. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
How did you physically keep the diary? Because I find it interesting reading diaries. And you can tell sort of how someone is writing it in that, you know, two of the most famous diarists in the UK, Tony Benn, a former Labour Party politician, he recorded his every night. And then only afterwards were they transcribed and turned into books. Alistair Campbell, the former spin doctor for Tony Blair, wrote his hurriedly in shorthand at the end of every night. So you read them and they're more sort of urgent and staccato. How do you go about keeping your diary?
I type my diary. I need to put it down, to type it. I do not necessarily write or compel myself to write every day. I write whenever I feel I have something to say, I feel I have something to work out, emotions, ideas, whatever.
So it's not at the end of the day, right, I must now.
No, there's no must in my case. I just write when I need to write, which is often every day and often more times during the day. So some days I have 5, 6, 7, 8 entries during the day. And I write it without no censorship, self-censorship whatsoever. I just pour my feelings, my ideas out and put it in the drawer. And then later on, if I want to turn it into a book, or then I would read and it would bring back everything to me. And I find, actually, I always recommend to people to keep a diary. It's a very good way of living.
And is it one of those things that you can sort of go back to even a month afterwards when you're angry about something that is happening, the politics or the actuality of the place you're in? Is it something you can come back to a month afterwards and go, well, actually, this time last month it was worse? Is it something that can give you sort of succor even in a short-term way?
Yes, sometimes less than a month. Sometimes I'm shocked reading it a week later. Mm-hmm. But usually it's worse when it makes me feel better to do it.
Yeah.
So it's part of therapy as well.
And I guess there's that thing, as Steve was saying with Alistair Campbell's diaries, that they're sort of scribbled down. You don't feel that they've been edited. I mean, I guess they have, but there's a courage in publishing your diaries unedited from the day in which you wrote them. I guess that is an interesting thing. Are yours much different from the pen and paper that they started off as?
In some cases, yes, but in most cases, it's a success of a good diary book is that it should read as a diary. It's not something, and if you've made a mistake in predicting something, you don't change it because it turned out to be different. So honesty is very
otherwise
important.
It's a time machine, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. And then, of course, the other thing is in a diary, you expose yourself. And there's something about that and how far you can go. And it's a risk you take, but it's a worthwhile risk because the reader of a diary must trust you, trust that you are writing honestly. Otherwise,
and getting it wrong is obviously one of those important things. Absolutely. And finally, I wanted to ask you about the idea of coexistence, Israel and Palestine's coexistence. I think you say that it could be analogous to the situation between France and Germany now within Europe, and that they actually have a shared space on the West Bank. How do you see this playing itself?
Well, I am against the idea that there would never be coexistence between Palestinians and Israeli Jews, because in fact there was a long history of coexistence between Arabs and Jews, Muslims, Christians, and Jews in the Palestine, geographic Palestine. So the years of intolerance are historically very short and brief. But at the same time, as long as the colonization that is taking place now in the occupied territories continues, there's no room for coexistence because you don't coexist with the colonizer. You have to end the colonization, end the occupation, and then the road is open. I think what we would be surprised by is how quickly the change happens once the political situation changes, because people prefer to build a common future. And I think there's a lot of possibilities for a common future. And I'm talking about the common future not only in Palestine, Israel, but in the whole region, because the whole region is interdependent, the whole region east of the Mediterranean. And for more than 400 years, it was one political entity, one political under the Ottomans.
You sound almost optimistic, which I love, because optimism is a great thing. And yet there's very little to actually be optimistic about at the moment. There isn't there?
That's true. The situation is dreadful. But at the same time, without hope, how can one survive? You have to constantly realize that it will end one day, as between France and England it ended after many centuries of conflict. Things do not continue forever in conflict.
Well, for the time being, Raja Shahade, author of Occupation Diaries, thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
Pleasure.
Up next, we'll be speaking to two filmmakers about Vietnam vets. Stay tuned.
Monocle Film stepped into the kitchen to watch Chef Jonathan Conroy prepare the perfect summer meal. A traditional Turkish starter, spaghetti vongole from the Med, and a quintessential British classic, the raspberry trifle, deliciously take shape on screen.
The fresh coriander is a really important thing. You have to be heavy-handed on that. Over-generous on the coriander. It's meant to, every flavour should pack a punch.
Summer on a Plate, on film, on monocle.com.
Nestled into the urban fabric of London, Hong Kong, New York and Tokyo, Monocle shops are small, cosy outposts of everything we care about. That's incredible design, credible provenance, charming service and, of course, intelligent journalism. Stock up on the latest issue of the magazine, browse our carefully curated selection of books and music, or seek out your favourite back issue to fill that gap in your Monocle archive. So, drop in to one of our shops, and our friendly staff will be on hand to show you around. For addresses and opening hours, visit monocle.com.
And welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Robert Bound.
When British filmmaker Michael Grigsby visited three Vietnam War veterans in 1970, he captured a portrait of youths staring into an uncertain future after the trauma of war. But the story doesn't end there. After a celebrated career in documentaries, Grigsby's latest film, We Went to War, heads back to the Texas town 40 years on and those three same boys, now a little older and wiser. But does war become something you can live with? Michael Grigsby and producer Rebecca Tolley join us now to explain. Mike and Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Now, most people, when they settle down in front of a film that is about war veterans, I'll turn to you first, Michael, perhaps, because you were obviously there 40 years ago to make the first one too. Don't expect such a calm, reflective film. There's backtracking to your film before, but other than that, these guys exist in a very calm space, but the film is very much about their heads, I guess.
But I think that's probably the key to those particular films and perhaps the way in which I work. I think it's really important that we find space within ourselves and within the images and give space to the people with whom one is working in the film so that they feel calm, they feel they can trust you, and they feel that you don't come in with a preset agenda where you're going to interrogate them with lots of questions and interrupting. And I think that's the initial film, I Was a Soldier. The young men then were really surprised. I got to know them quite well beforehand, which is always the key to trust. They were quite surprised. I never talked or asked them about the war. I just talked about now and how they were re-evaluating their lives in terms of normality and abnormality, the abnormality being in their head. Yeah. And the only way that they could explain that or convey that visually was just to be themselves. And if they wanted to stop talking, as they did, and nothing happened for a few moments, we just let the cameras roll. But you could hear the normality of the sheep and the cows around them, but you could see the pain and the confusion in their eyes. And I think that's why the film still lives today, has a lot of power today. And when Rebecca saw that film and encouraged us to go back, we felt that this was the approach we should and must take. I just feel that as filmmakers, we often tend to rush into subjects and into people's lives and then leave them again without any kind of feeling of space for them, but for their community and their environment. So that's the way it is.
And how long did it take for you to kind of turn the cameras on? Rebecca, I wonder whether this is sort of normal practice. Seeing the way that Michael works seems unusual, and in a good way, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as Michael said, I mean, we very much believe that as a continuation, in a sense, of the first film, I Was a Soldier, that it, you know, we'd adopt the same approach, because that was really one of the most powerful things for me watching that film for the first time about 4 years ago, was that I was so struck because the film allowed me into their heads without too much distraction. And it was, you know, that really got me. And so, you know, that was the approach. And I think that it was really borne out by the fact that when we went back to Texas in 2009 to kind of re-engage, or Mike to re-engage, and me for the first time, obviously, that although there had been no contact between Mike and them in the intervening years, they wholeheartedly remembered that experience as a positive one, and that trust still remained. And so that they were open to, you know, again, having that mirror put up to their lives, which is a very brave thing to do. And especially when you've lived that life after that event, and then the cameras have come and then they've gone away, and then the rest of your life takes place. And the events of your early life really mark the rest of your life. That's a very courageous thing to go down that path with a couple of filmmakers.
Why didn't people seek help? The Vietnam veteran is a whole different kind of person. I don't think you want to know until you have to know. If it's not broke, don't fix it. I think my generation has that attitude, the flower power and all that. We wanted to be free. Also, the baby boomers are a generation that didn't think they'd ever get old or didn't worry about it. Granted, I saw enough to scare the living hell out of me that I'll never forget. It's like your worst nightmare, fear, just comes at you all of a sudden. And it's like watching a horror show, some big monster. And it's death. It's death looking you in the face. So, you know, you think, hey, I can get killed here. It's a kind of rude awakening.
I want to pick up on that point about going back 40 years on, because obviously it's one thing for the two of you to say, right, we're going to, you know, Mike say, right, I want to go and do this again 40 years on, and Rebecca, you to say, yes, I think it's a great project, let's go and do it. And you can see why you might think that now's the right time to do it. But for the three people involved, was there any, when you went back, was there any, Mike, any initial resistance of like, well, we've done that and it was, I'm glad we did it, but to do it again, I'm not so sure?
I felt absolutely no resistance at all. And in fact, going back after all that time was kind of surreal, but very moving. And the trust I talked about earlier that we had, I think, established in 1970 was there. And you either know you've got that trust or you haven't. And they embraced us in every sense to actually perhaps be honest and open with us, as they have been in this, we went to war, and say, let's do this film. And we want somebody to listen to us again, because nobody basically is listening.
To add to that, I mean, as an aside, David, one of the characters in the film, said to me as an aside in 2009, you know, that crazy Englishman coming here 40 years ago, that was the best therapy I could have had. He said, because nobody had asked me before or since, you know, how do you feel? So, you know, that was a real testament to Mike as not only a filmmaker, but as a human being. That was a great testament to him. And that had lasted in that guy's mind.
And I think, sorry, just from what Reb was saying, then we spent a lot of time with them again. not talking about the film or about how they felt, but just hanging out with them. And that's ultimately what it's all about, is finding our space with their space and giving them the time they deserve and the time we need in order to try and understand where they're coming from and how they've changed in this 40-year journey. And we've all aged, but we've also grown in different ways. And then how do we actually feel that and understand that? And you only do that by just spending time and time and time. And we did that a lot.
I think one of the most interesting things about this project to me is that we're in a situation now where you've got a new generation of young veterans who've come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And there's a lot of discussion about what they might do next and how they're feeling and how they cope with it. But through this film, you're able to give some sort of idea of not what life's going to be like 5 years down the line, or 10 years down the line, but in a generation's time, in 40 years' time. Yeah. What lessons do you think there are there from what's happened to your three guys that will help anyone who wants to sort of think about how to deal with returning veterans now?
Well, I think there's just one little story we can give you, that we this film was screened at an Odeon in Texas. People drove for 4 or 5 hours, actually, to see it. They just heard about it. And after one of the screenings, David, one of the characters in the film, came out, and there was a family group standing there with the boy, 22 years of age, standing to one side. And they recognised David, and he went over. And they said, look, our son's just come back recently from Iraq, and he's a changed boy. And what do we do? And David immediately got on his mobile and got this man counselling, which started the following morning. And it was that recognition by them that they'd driven so far that they felt that perhaps they might get some help or support from seeing the movie. And after one of the screens, a veteran from Vietnam came up to me, who I'd never met, and just said, thanks so much for that film, because seeing these men have the courage to be themselves and so open and honest in this film has given me the courage now to actually go out there and seek help. And I think your question's absolutely right. I think when Rebecca and I first talked about it again for this new film, the whole thing of Afghanistan, Iraq, was very much in our heads.
Definitely.
Because war is war is war.
That's an interesting thing. I mean, with the three conflicts we've just been talking about, are it seems that they're not. It seems that the troops are going off to the chorus of a lot of naysaying from people in their countries, marches. And I wonder if recovering from the shock of the war, the stuff that you see, is particularly difficult when there are lots of people in the newspapers and on television saying that we shouldn't have gone there in the first place, which clearly is the big Vietnam parallel.
That is definitely so with Vietnam, and I think that's probably the biggest difference now, I think, because yes, of course, there's lots of us who are, you know, against the war in Iraq, etc. But I think the big difference is now that soldiers in the main are coming home and are being recognised. Whether you agree with the war that they go and fight in is another thing altogether, but they're not vilified like Vietnam vets were vilified when they came home. And that is a big difference. I think for a lot of Vietnam vets, they're glad of this film. The ones that have seen her are glad of this film, but they also recognise they're doing it for all veterans. That's what they said, you know, this is for all veterans. And that young Iraq veteran, actually, he was 22 years of age, and he did actually say that the film had made him realise what would happen if he didn't get help.
Yeah, well, I also wondered that, watching the film, I sort of wondered whether these three guys were, it was 40 years since you last went down to their town. I wonder whether they spent those last 40 years waiting for you to come back. Did you get that sense? I kind of did, actually. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just feel that there was sort of another, like, oh, here's someone that finally, you know.
I think metaphorically speaking, yes,
kind of,
I would say. I think it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, 40 years is a long time. And I think, actually, I have just remembered this, and this is true, that David Johnson in the film did say, I knew he would come back. I knew he would come back. And I've just remembered that. But Dennis, who was, like, you know, a real character in the film, he just says, well, hey, I just got on with my life, you know.
It sounds like Gandalf. It's turned into Gandalf, Michael.
No, there's a thought.
We can't leave it there. But we're almost going to have to. Michael Grigsby and Rebecca Tolley, co-authors of We Went to War. Thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank it's you very much.
Thank
you. Thank you.
And you are successfully tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. We're going to have a song now. This is new from Japan, some perfect breezy Sunday pop. This is Shantaro Sakamoto with In a Phantom Mood.
The nominees for one of the literary calendar's hotly anticipated dates were announced this week, and we're lucky enough to be joined by the historian, writer and Man Booker Prize judge, Amanda Foreman. Amanda, a very warm welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hello.
Before we get on to how you judge these books and what goes on inside the room, because that's what I'm most fascinated about, can you give us a very quick, brief and dirty, these are the six and this is what they're there for?
Okay, in no particular order, there is The Lighthouse by Alison Moore, which is an homage to the suspense that Hitchcock used to give us. It's a very taut, frightening book about one of the world's most pathetic losers. The next is Jeet Tyal's book, Narcopolis. He's an Indian writer, he's an Indian poet. This is his first novel. He was a well-known drug addict in the 70s and 80s, and this book is about Bombay in that time and how the drug trade changed from opium to heroin. Next,
sounds like it's taking us to Will Self.
Funny enough, I am actually going to Will Self. Will Self, Umbrella. This book has caused controversy because it's written in the modernist style. If anyone's ever read James Joyce, you'll recognise it immediately. And people have complained that it's difficult to read. That is probably true. This isn't beach reading. But it's an outstanding novel, complicated, soaring, tragic, about a woman who has an undiagnosed mental disorder and is stuck in a mental hospital in London. Final three, Hilary Mantel's Bring Up the Bodies. This is the sequel to the first, Wolf Hall. It's almost impossible to write a sequel that is as good or better than the first.
And yet,
Hilary Mantel has done it. It's very exciting. This really is an amazing read. Next, we have Deborah Levy's Swimming Home. This is her first novel in 14 years. And it's a very, very tautly written tragedy set in France about the death of a poet. There's a slight Hitchcock flavour in this one too. And what's remarkable about Deborah Levy is that although she had a huge splash 14 years ago, she couldn't get this novel published by anybody. And in the end, an independent subscription-only publisher called And Other Stories published this novel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to 2,000 copies. And it just goes to show novelists out there, never, ever give up.
Wow. I love that. That's heartwarming.
It is, isn't
Brilliant.
It?
Brilliant. Final one.
And the final one is Tan Tuan Eng's The Garden of Evening Mist. And this is set in Malaysia, and it has to do with a Malaysian female judge who is retiring. She's losing her memory, and she goes back to a garden that she created with the help of a Japanese gardener. And then it turns out that she was a prisoner of war in a Japanese concentration camp, and this gardener was also involved in these Japanese concentration camps. And so there's a twist to the story. And what's amazing about this is that Tan Tuan Eng, who's first language is not English, has written one of the most beautiful novels written in years.
Wow.
It's a pretty spellbinding list, isn't it? I could sort of sit and listen to sort of hearing just what those books are about.
Yeah, let alone sitting down and reading them.
Bewitching sort of events. Last year, the kind of vibe was all about readability. What's the vibe this year? Hopefully it's not. That sort of is taken as a benchmark of just in case the book is tricky, just in case it doesn't fit on the daytime TV sofa. What do you think, Amanda?
Has
it switched up a gear?
Well, you know, I really think that it was a slip of the tongue. Mm. I really don't think that the judges meant it the way it was taken, and it was just very bad luck on them. And if you actually look at those individual judges, they're all very distinguished people with great literary pedigrees, and sometimes at the heat of the moment in a press conference you say something unfortunate and it haunts you forever, as it did them. So there was no deliberate decision to take it up a notch this year. It's just that there are this time four academics and one non-academic, who's Dan Stevens, the actor, who is himself, though, very academic, you know, did very well at Cambridge, read English, has started his own magazine. You know, he's no slouch.
He's no slouch.
He's no pretty face. I think all judges try, at least I hope they do, to establish a criteria. But in the case of the Booker, and I say this having judged a lot of prizes in my life, it's different. First of all, at the very beginning of the meetings, and the meetings take a year, we all sit down and we agree what the criteria is going to be. And the one thing that isn't allowed is, I like this book. This, you know, doesn't really matter whether you like it. And it's banned from the discussions.
So are you really going on purely scholarly lines then? It's not about liking stuff.
I think scholarly makes it sound dreary. But I would say that there's an established criteria of literary value.
Between readability and scholastic excellence.
Yes, or aesthetics. Aesthetic value.
Or you have to explain why you like the book rather than just, yeah.
Yes.
I like it, but yeah. And just these because are the reasons why it works for me.
Exactly. Yes, that we can all agree on. And I think rather than saying that a book should be readable, you should say a book shouldn't be impenetrable. Mm. I think
they're two pretty different things, aren't they?
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether it's Channel 4 or the BBC. I think it's the BBC that covers the prize giving live.
Yes.
The announcement of the prize giving. It's the Turner Prize at Channel 4, I think.
Yeah.
I always feel like the best, an even better TV show would be deciding who the judges who are going to judge the books are, right? So how do you get to be a judge of the book?
You know, you can't apply. You get selected.
Yeah. And
it's a bit like winning a prize yourself.
Yeah.
I live.
Have you been waiting for years for this moment to be tapped on the shoulder?
Well, the funny thing is, it never occurred to me that I'd ever be asked because I'm a historian, and I just assumed that it would be, you know, academics, English literature academics, and novelists, and then the occasional Stardust thrown in.
Jerry Hall.
For example. No, she did not. She did the Orange Prize.
I know.
That really would be scraping the barrel. So, you know, and once you're asked, I mean, of course, you say yes. And then they
send you 200 books that you have to read.
They do. And now, I have to say, this is a compensated job. So you're not donating your time for free. And all I can say is thank goodness for that. Because it takes over your life. You have 145 books to read, and you need to read all 145 in about four or five months. And you meet every month. The meetings take between 4 and 5 hours. They are invigilated, they're observed, they're minuted. This is no slouchy lying on a
this
sofa.
This isn't just a boozy lunch, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Like,
no.
Which one did you like? Well, Will Self, yes. He hasn't been nominated for a while. Let's have him on.
Yeah, it's a fascinating process. This is pucker, kosher, yes. Everything else that ends in an A or an O or an ER, right?
It's the real thing. And each of the judges has to give about 5 minutes on each novel. That's why it takes so long, you can imagine. So we'd get through about 20 novels over those 4 hours.
And you must be in a great position to sort of see the sort of ebb and flow of themes that happen in any given year.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, I presume when you're getting your long list and your shortlist together, you're looking for an anti-theme. You don't want to have this year is about things that sound like Alfred Hitchcock or whatever. But I guess you want six books that are very different.
Yeah, we're not interested in themes at all. As you rightly point out, one does start to see themes that obviously are in the ether. There were quite a lot of books on incest.
Mm.
Quite a few dodgy uncles, for some reason, I noticed over and over again.
Some stock characters here.
Yes, you think, oh, what is it with uncles, you know, this year?
There were obviously a lot of weddings last year.
Something, you know.
Who's that dancing?
Weddings, yeah, last year. This year it was dodgy uncles. And then endless secret murders.
Mm.
You know, somebody killed, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Mm.
The odd questionable sexuality, double, triple takes, you know, that kind of stuff.
I wanted to ask you another thing about the sort of commercial side of of this year's shortlist, basically, because there are two, as we mentioned with Deborah Levy's book, also the Lighthouse, Alison Moore's book, is published by Salt, isn't it, which is another teeny-weeny publisher.
Teeny-weeny.
This is great stuff. I mean, Faber on it with a couple of books. There's all the sort of, not necessarily usual suspects, but I guess you always think there might be a Faber book on there. But there's two small publishers. That's a great...
Three, actually. Myrmidon is very
Myrmidon
small, too.
Isn't it? I mean, obviously you would not consider them purely for the size of their publisher. But that must be kind of a nice thing to do, even if it's by accident, that you are kind of giving a boost to the publishing industry, not just by awarding a cash to a novelist.
It's so true. And it is purely by accident. Mm. And you feel really great when you do that. I mean, when we'd finally got to the end and we realised we had three men, three women, that although we had no Scots, sadly, for those who care about having Scots on the list, it certainly had a broad geographical range. And yeah, you do feel good about that. Because it'd be a shame if your taste was so narrow and you didn't know it and you were just merely replicating some preordained pattern.
How do you read them? When you've got 145 books to read in four months, do you have more than one on the go at a time, or are you quite sort of right, I'm going to read one book over the next 3 days and when I'm done with that, I'm going to move on to the next book? And do you also, do all the judges decide we're going to read them in a certain order so that we can all talk about them at the same time?
Yes. Well, everything is read in the same order. Otherwise, you can't discuss them.
Yeah.
And they're numbered, 1, 2, 3, 4, in the order they come in, just to make it,
Very fair.
Yeah, without prejudice. And then we're expected to take notes. I mean, otherwise, literally, you cannot remember them. And even now, embarrassingly, as I look at my shelf, I realise I cannot remember anything about in novel A that I know I read and didn't like.
But you can't remember why you didn't like it and what happened in it at all.
No.
But it's not like a blind tasting. You know, you get the cover, you get, I mean, obviously they're all promo copies or pre-published copies possibly, but you know who the author and what the title is and all the rest of it, right? It's not like not like a wine tasting.
It's not like that. Although, you know, there's something very helpful about reading a novel that's already been reviewed. Maybe it's just sheer laziness on my part. But if you read a novel and you've read the reviews, then you have something to react against. Whereas otherwise, you're cutting through the jungle brush yourself. And it just requires that much more skill and criticism and attention to detail so that you formed a raw opinion. And it's mentally exhausting, actually doing it again and again and again.
Did you find it difficult to go back to reading just for yourself? When you'd finished all 145, did you then think one night, oh, I'll go to bed, I'll read a book? No, actually, the last thing I want to do now is read a book.
Yes, I watched a lot of television, to be honest, as a way of shutting off.
Really into South Park.
I'm very into Grimm at the moment. It's this American. Yeah. I love it. American series. It's fantastic. And then if I really, really wanted to read something, I would read something by Owen Colfer. I love the Artemis Fowl series or Rick Reardon. You know, just, stuff that didn't tax my brain in that way.
And as a historian, I mean, your set texts are presumably very different from this. This is a kind of nice break from the border to be sort of enveloped in fiction for a few months.
It is fantastic. Yeah. Because nothing I read ever reaches the level of this kind of writing. And at the moment, I'm writing a book on the history of women. And I am sorry to say that the level of writing in women's history doesn't aspire to Booker Prize quality.
But does your story of
does it actually affect the way that you're writing now?
Well, do you know, the reason I was chosen, as opposed to any other non-fiction writer, is that the thing that makes me is that is what I do care about. I really care about the beauty of each sentence. Now, not all historians care about that, but I do. And so, in a way, it was a perfect fit. Not in the novel world, not in the fiction world, and yet understanding its ideals and subscribing to it.
And presumably the last 200, you know, the late 18th and 19th centuries are chock full of amazing women novelists. This is a big part of the story of women, presumably the last sort of 250 years. So that's a huge part, presumably, of this history in itself.
Well, exactly. Right? Yes. Yes.
It's win-win. It's double tick.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a busman's holiday. Well,
it was. Yeah, and you're right. It has raised my game, especially reading the people on the shortlist. They're all incredible writers. They all have this tremendous attention to detail. I spoke to Tan Tuan Eng, for example, who wrote in The Garden of Evening Mists. And he said to me, I'm so glad you like my book. And I said, yes,
I love it. He dropped you around a nice magnum of champagne.
He did, yes, chocolate, flowers. Nice. In fact, the gifts
haven't stopped coming. Well, we can unveil the winner of the Man Booker Prize 2012.
I asked him, how he'd gone on to structure this book. And instead of answering that question, he said, what I really want to talk to you about is how I write my sentences. He said, I rewrite them again and again and again. And I said, that was very apparent. Because each sentence is so beautiful, and whether you read it out loud or read it just inside your head, you can feel the beauty. It starts to sparkle. It really does.
This is the one that's jumping off the list for me, actually.
I'm Garden of Evening Mists. Right now, put some money on it.
I'm going down Daunt Books straight away to get into that. For the time being, when is the fated day?
16th of October, I believe.
16th of October. We can let the cat out of the bag, Steve. Yeah. We know, don't we?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
For the time being, Amanda Foreman, thank you very much for joining us on The Weekly. Shame the mics weren't live there when Amanda told us who'd won the Booker Prize, Steve. But anyway, there you go, listeners.
Yeah.
Tune in.
I'm going to be very rich after putting all that money on Will Self.
Who liked today's edition of the Monocle Weekly? I did.
I did too.
And Raja Shahade, on the other hand, Occupation Diaries. He was a very interesting man. I loved those diaries that he's written.
He was. And I just love the idea of, telling the story of what's happening in Palestine through the diaries and through that minutiae. And he does it beautifully.
The Vietnam director, Michael, and Rebecca, they were good. They were good. I think that's sort of like is another strangely calm way of looking at something pretty horrific and strange.
It's an incredible film. It's doing the festival circuit at the moment. It's on in London, I think, later this month, and going all around the world as well.
It's the end of the show.
Yep.
That's all from edition 167 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and managed in the studio by Jack Phillips. But for now, should I say, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Steve Bloomfield.
Thanks for tuning in.